bus yesterday afternoon on some stories was very, very helpful and very kind, so I'm very happy to do this. Like college football fans and the ultra-rich, we writers are a tribal people. There are imagists and maximalists. There is confessionalism and whatever auto-fiction is. There are those who write their drafts in Garamond, and those poor souls typing away in Times New Roman who lack even a modicum of self-respect. Therese Sabota, however, takes the lines drawn in the literary sand and wipes them away like the genre-destroying tide she is. Not only does she write fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, she writes all of them really, really well. She is also a librettist, which is a term I had to look up, and it means someone who writes the text to an opera or musical, and that's pretty damn cool. I may or may not have experienced a personal crisis when I realized that Therese Sabota is killing it in genres I didn't even understand. The first work of Sabota's I encountered was her novel, Tin God. It's a wonderful piece of fabulous fiction that switches back and forth between the foibles of small-town Nebraska and the brutal affair between a Spanish conquistador and young Native American woman. In very Midwest fashion, the element that unites the two storylines is not an artifact that has been passed down through the generations or a sort of Toni Morrison genetic memory, but a piece of land. Because in Sabota's work, the Midwest is not a blank, moral-ish canvas on which intellectuals from the West and East Coasts paint the ideologies they think they're rebelling against. In her work, the Midwest is real, with real people and real problems. The opening to Tin God is emblematic. Hi, this is God, G-O-D, God with all the big letters, and I'm out here in the middle of a field. Later in the novel, God makes an appearance as a big-bosomed waitress at a diner who makes a mean sheet cake. That's the type of gut maker I want to meet. There's something about Sabota's writing that resonates deeply with me on a spiritual level as well. Nothing is mundane. A trailer park is as full of the breath of creation as New York City. Even the badlands around the trailer park are worthy of attention, as the narrator in the novella Trailer Girl notes. The gully is all promise. The sky dips in everywhere, and what grows in it doesn't have to be planted. All those blue flowers and black-eyed flowers and flowers with thorns at the base and big green prickly bunches in a sword shape that aren't cactus but look like something an old lady would tend in a size small pot, though. Beauty abounds as well in her poem Crash and a Half, which explores what happens to the kernels of artistic ideas that will never see the light of day. And you, half-brained, mea culpa the air, where the data hadn't risen to cloud height, so suitable for burial, disremembered, dismembered. I love that line, disremembered, dismembered. Her art is often a celebration of what doesn't last, of the rich beauty of the finite. Sabota doesn't find the magic in the everyday. She knows it's already there, and she shines her light upon it. Her work is a testament to all the stories that should be shared if only we had the time. Death is coming for us all. Mea culpa while you can. Recipient of a 2013 Guggenheim, Therese Sabota is the author of 6 books of fiction, most recently Bohemian Girl, named one of the 10 best 2012 Westerns by Booklist, and a historical book of the year finalist in Forward. Tin God, a finalist for the John Gardner Prize, was recently reissued, with Publishers Weekly deeming her a fabulous fabulist. Astounding, proclaimed the New York Post in a review of her memoir, Black Glasses Like Clark Kent, that won the Grey Wolf Nonfiction Prize and the Japan Times Best of Asia 2008. Vogue lauded her first novel, Cannibal, A Female Heart of Darkness. Sabota is also the recipient of the Bobbs Prize, the Iowa Prize for Poetry, the O. Henry Award for the Short Story, and a 3-time winner of the New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship. Her opera, Wet, premiered at LA's Disney Hall in 2005. Her writing has been selected for the Writer's Choice column in New York Times Book Review, a Spin Magazine Book of the Year, and one of the Voice Literary Supplement's 10 Best Reads. It has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Paris Review, Narrative, One Story, American Poet, Poetry, Times Literary Supplement, Tin House, Yale Review, Slate, Chicago Tribune, and The New York Times. She is also the author of 5 books of prize-winning poetry and Clean the Crocodile's Teeth, translations from the Nuer, a South Sudanese language. She has enjoyed residencies at Bellagio, Bagliasco, Yaddo. Is it Yaddo or Yaddo? I've never... Yaddo, thank you. McDowell, the James Merrill House in Osoba. Her academic positions have been at Williams, Davidson, Columbia School of the Arts, William & Mary, San Francisco State, Bennington, Sarah Lawrence, New School, the Universities of Tampa, Miami, and Hawaii, as well as in St. Petersburg and Nairobi for the summer literary seminars. She is a graduate of the University of British Columbia and Columbia University. Please welcome to the stage, Teresa Boda.
Do I want beer? Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction. I feel like I feel very important, and I'm going to read to you every single word of all these books. Phew. So, but I did think I would dip into them, and I'd start with poetry because you're always so sharp at the beginning and critical. This poem is called Bridge, Mother, the comma between the two. Mother burns on the other side of the bridge. Mother burns the bridge and is safe on the other side. Mother is not on the bridge when it burns. When mother says burn, the bridge burns. We can't get to the other side. The bridge is burning. Mother is the bridge we burn. She is how we get to the other side. We can't burn the bridge without her. Mother burns and we burn, bridge or no bridge. She is the other side. Nothing burns the bridge, and then it burns. Good. I'm glad you liked it. So, the wonderful Anhinga Press. Anhinga Press published this. 30 years of my work. 30 years. They did a fabulous job. The cover is by Jay, as you might imagine, wild and crazy. This is called Pink. In China, I remembered you only once. The restaurant's speciality, chosen from a braid of live varieties, spiraled to the floor, while the waiter flayed it with a knife flicked from his wrist. The snake made your initial over and over the black tile. What pain! Love's all touch was the ideogram it made as it crossed the hot stones to the table. I'm warning you, I only know one joke, and I made it up, and I'm not telling you for a while. I know poets are supposed to have this patter, right? Well, I just have one joke, and later. This is called Christmas House. I don't know if you know my writing well enough to know that this is not going to be a particularly cheerful poem. Could I plunge my ballpoint into your throat the moment you purple? Even then. Make a gaping hole for the air where the syllable catches. If we invented whipped cream and its canister to deplete the ozoned air, that suicidal turn, what about a gingerbread bean to block it? You breathe gingerly, Heimlich bruised, and the boy under the tree points the canister down his throat and misses, the spray making a kind of white beard. It's for him you are saved, and the house. I grab the one throwing himself over the edge of the carriage, who does an entrechat being lifted, whose syllable is la after force feeding. As the dog takes the food pellet by pellet to the carpet and swallows, we forget how brave the baby is. All right, I'll read. Maybe one or two more. Let's see what we have here. One of my favorites, now that you're all warmed up, called Obscenity. I lived in the South Sudan for a year, and of course it changed my life, and I've only been back once. The person who made the people that I had done the translations for famous was called Evans Pritchard, and he was a famous British social anthropologist. He founded the discipline on that study, and then, of course, later they discovered that the New Era Society was really based on the British imperialist. But when I was there, it did seem to be based on the British imperialist, so it was like not news to me that 20 years later they debunk everything. So it starts with a quote from Evans Pritchard. Obscenity is often an expression uttered by an individual under great stress and condemned as bad taste, but it is really one permitted and even prescribed by society. It was 1925. Among the Ba'ila, among as if swarming the petri dish of the British imperialist, there exist expressions used collectively, that is, in the presence of women and children, in fact, in chorus, since these obscenities are sung, not scrawled across a riverbank where innocent boaters of Victorian persuasion might encounter them. His great penis is a size, a thing without end. It must have a long unwinding. The female mourner's song, the trot arch, as if the words themselves might make the gourd warrior rise in tumescence. Sometimes it's just what they do with their hands, singing, writes the patrician scientist, who considered obscenity a privilege, a way to spur routine labor with ardor, or to invoke life at the moment of death. I drag in the anthropological so one can reject the paradigm of the primitive. We who have no physical labor, which requires our neighbor, nor sustained interest in creation, except in art, that work to ward off death. There will always be those in the boat who slow down, who listen and transcribe in their tiny script. Thank you. I'm having another book published in September of poetry, and this is one of the poems that's included. It's being published by China Mielville's, the science fiction writer's magazine called Salvage. He's an anarchist, a British anarchist, and that's the magazine slant. I have just the poem. Waziristan. And it starts with a quote from Richard Christensen, the NASA subcontractor. He says, "We're not darkening the skies yet, but we are poised." Doodlebugs over St. Paul's, wind and smash, the V1s quick to drop death impersonally. Why start with the English? Matthew Arnold, the droning clash at the cliffs, infrared across a darkling plain, God at the controls from an off-site screen. Enhanced eye is not please. The Pakistani in the photo bears what's left, silver shards. He disappears, we disappear him, ditto his wife. And the photo, cornfields buzz with toy predators that slice the sky over our waving grain for weed or for immigrants. FDR, we are descended from immigrants and revolutionists. Remember, remember always. It's bird watching, except the drones bag you. Soon they fly en masse, flocks smarter than ever. There's a cave ahead for us, the Morlocks. All day, four of them weighing the sky, the brain. With seraphim flinging fire, who needs air? No wonder bombs try Times Square. And that's a bridge, too. Anything that burns you. This biography I've just published in February. It's a portrait of Lola Ridge, radical poet, and the title is from an interview that she had with Catherine Ann Porter, an interview with an English critic who asked her what was the appropriate topic for poetry, and that was her answer, anything that burns you. I'll read a little bit at the beginning, a couple of her poems, and then the ending, because of course that's how you would read it if you're going to look at it to buy. You're not going to look at all my footnotes, are you? I hope not. So it starts with a quote from Catherine Ann Porter, who was a journalist then and not such a famous short story writer, and she was covering the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti in 1927. One tall, thin figure of a woman stepped out alone, a good distance into the empty square. And when police came down at her and the horse's hooves beat over her head, she did not move, but stood with her shoulders slightly bowed, entirely still. The charge was repeated again and again, but she was not to be driven away. A man near me said in horror, suddenly recognizing her, "That's Lola Ridge." In 1927, Lola Ridge was known to a huge public primarily as the author of The Ghetto and Other Poems, a book that portrays the immigrant as human, struggling, yes, but with hopes for the future. Sacco and Vanzetti were two such immigrants about to be executed for crimes they most likely did not commit. Ridge, too, was an immigrant, having traveled across the Pacific from New Zealand. Her presence at the demonstration was announced in advance on the front pages of major newspapers as an important witness to the event. She was also an anarchist, when anarchy was a political possibility, especially among intellectuals and artists and immigrants. Those who had left their home country to pursue the dream of freedom that in this country had promised that the, this country, no, wait a minute. The dream of freedom in the country that promised it. All right, all right. So Ridge was one of the first to delineate the life of the poor in Manhattan and in particular women's lives in New York City. The title poem of her second book, Sun Up and Other Poems, is a striking modernist depiction of a bad girl's interior life. Harriet Monroe, founder of poetry, and William Rose Benet, founder of the Saturday Review of Literature, called Ridge a genius. 4 years before Eliot's bleak and anti-Semitic The Wasteland, her equally long poem The Ghetto celebrated the otherness of the Jewish Lower East Side and prophesied the multi-ethnic world of the 21st century. Her subject was rethought along Whitmanian lines, and here's a small bomb. Yet here is a small bomb of a poem, which was likened to the poetry of H.D. and Emily Dickinson, that remains for me a model of imagist engagement with the world. It was written sometime between 1911 and 1918, when there was a serious depression going on in New York, and you would see immigrants sitting on the park benches everywhere with their boaters over their heads, sleeping. Debris, I love those spirits that men stand off and point at, or shudder and hood up their souls. Those ruined ones where liberty has lodged an hour and passed like flame, burning asunder the too small house. At the end of the teens in the early 1920s, when Ridge was one of the editors of Others and then Broom Magazine, she presided over Thursday afternoon salons filled with modernist hotshots, eating slices of Ridge's cake and drinking whatever prohibition would allow or not. William Carlos Williams and Robert McAlmon hatched plans for the magazine contact. 20-year-old Hart Crane flirted with everyone in sight. Marianne Moore read drafts of her own work, and Mayakovsky stomped on her coffee table. In 1919, Ridge gave a speech in Chicago entitled Woman and the Creative Will, about how sexually constructed gender roles hinder female development. That was 10 years before Virginia Woolf wrote A Room of One's Own. Woman is not and has not and never has been man's natural inferior, Ridge announced. Although she wrote little personal poetry, Ridge advocated individual liberty. She supported not only the rights of women, but laborers, blacks, Jews, immigrants, and homosexuals. She wrote about lynchings, executions, race riots, and imprisonment. As a rebellious lefty, she interacted closely with the most radical women of her time, editing Margaret Sanger's magazine on birth control in 1918, and reciting her own poems at Emma Goldman's deportation dinner. Eventually, she was arrested during that demonstration against the execution of Sacco Vanzetti and hauled off with Edna St. Vincent Millay. And in 1936, watching a May Day parade in Mexico City, she raised her fist in solidarity with the marching communists. So, let's see, I was going to read a couple of her poems. I'm particularly fond of her poems in her second book, I Guess I Like Bad Girls. And anybody who has mutilated a Barbie can relate to this. I beat Janie, Janie is the doll, and beat her, but still she smiled. So I scratched her between the eyes with a pin. Now she doesn't love me anymore. She scowls and scowls, though I begged her to forgive me and poured sugar at the hole in the back of her head. Let's see. Oh, and one other short poem. Hart Crane's copy of Lola Ridge's book. He only wrote, I think, one review, and that was of her book. His copy at the Columbia Rare Book Library opens to this poem. It's kind of an S&M version of his. Brooklyn Bridge. Pythonous body, arching over the night like an ecstasy. I feel your coils tightening and the world's lessening breath. That's what they were all writing about the city then, but I thought she had captured something about that bridge I had never noticed before. The Occupy generation that cites a continuous lineage from Whitman should be asking why today's students read Fascist, Pound, or Eliot and think there's no political bias in literature and condemn the writing of proletariat modernism for being leftist. Why, too, are the futurist background and fascism always mentioned in literary histories, but not an individual poet's penchant for anarchism, the total freedom that Americans have historically espoused in art of all kinds? Women who focused on what shapes human consciousness rather than the individual psyche have been particularly neglected, as if that stance is a male prerogative. When Ridge wrote, modernism was open to politics as an unexplored subject, especially for women, and for that matter, anyone else in subjugation. The question was how to freely represent their suffering and struggle. The activist writers of the Occupy generation now have the opportunity to reoccupy that question. So Ridge saw very clearly where freedom's repression could lead. Her brilliant sonnet, Electrocution, written before Sacco and Vanzetti were executed, the only poem that matches her acute social conscience with her wavering ability with form, she was best in free verse, captures the way democracy deals finally with its people. Electrocution. He shudders, feeling on the shaved spot the probing wind that stabs him to a thought of storm-drenched fields in a white foam of light, and roads of his hill town that leap to sight like threads of tortured silver, while the guards, monstrous deaf dolls that move as if on a string, in wanted haste to finish with this thing, turn faces blanker than asphalted yards. They heard the shriek that tore out of its sheath, but as a feeble moan, yet dared not breathe, who stared there at him arching, like a tree when winds wrench it and the earth holds tight, whose soul, expanding in white agony, had fused in flaming circuit with the night. So, I haven't told you my joke. It's one line. It's a poet's joke, all about topography. A man walks into a bra. Very good. But you're clever, very clever. So I'm going to read to you the opening bit of Tin God. It was, thank you for mentioning it in the introduction. My first novel was about being in the South Sudan, as you might imagine. And my problem with that was I couldn't figure out, I, after many years of writing it, I couldn't figure out how to get into the heads of Africans because I didn't know what they were thinking. And then I found out that the guy I was with was probably with the CIA, and then I figured I didn't know what anybody was thinking. So I wrote it in kind of a really high, tight first person. And so when I came to my second book, actually this is the third, but I wrote it as the second, I just gave up and wrote it in the voice of God, you know? Hi, this is God, G-O-D, God with all the big letters. I'm out here in the middle of a field. Oh yeah, I'm everywhere, duh. You can see me anytime, star side, whichever star keeps the quarks from going inside out. But right now I'm doing field work, work in the field. In particular, I'm broadcasting like the granite man on top of the Capitol building, the tallest in the state. The granite man whose hand casts out grain from a bag slung on his shoulder full of it. Broadcasting. You thought electricity, a TV special via satellite, a mile high, sent it to the sky? No, grain. Remember, I put the Virgin Mary on the front of a box of cornstarch, no Indian maiden. The feather in her hair is a nice touch for those who recall the Virgin's exit, doves and whatnot in the jet stream. It's got to be grain for that girl. Corn, sorghum, you name it. I broadcast it. I seed it. It's all about grain. It's not all about grain. It's grass, too. Grass I care a lot about. Grass is what you have when you don't plant, but I plant that, too. You see, this field hasn't been grain, grain, grain from kingdom come, a season of soybeans, a rotation of rye. I'm talking pre-interstate, pre-train, pre-wagon, pre-grain, when grass grew by itself, just as grass, up to here. And wind is what broadcast it then, meaning me, of course. A wind that never stops, a wind that pets and fingers and searches the grass for whatever's lost. Grain or what? Faith? Dope. I lay the grass bit on pretty thick. Anyway, that's the beginning of it. Thank you.